Thanks, everyone. I'm really happy to be here. I'm going to be talking to you mainly about how to make black holes out of dark matter and about why we should. So I'll start with some information that all of us already know, which is that most of the matter in the universe is dark, right? And there's lots of evidence that this is true. Maybe the most visually stark evidence is the bullet cluster, where we have the hot cluster gas has stalled out in the middle of these merging clusters. But the weak lensing mass profile shows that most of the mass has kept right on going. So that suggests that there's a whole bunch more mass than gas. So naturally, scientists have devoted quite a lot of effort to trying to figure out what this dark matter could be. And again, naturally, the way that we've mostly tried to do that is by looking for interactions with the matter that we're made out of. We look for interactions with Standard Model particles. And the community, over a timescale of decades, has invested a huge amount of effort in this project, right? So this is showing current or planned WIMP experiments. Each line is a different experiment. You can see this parameter space is quite constrained already. And despite this large investment of effort, we still have no evidence whatsoever that the dark matter interacts with Standard Model particles other than through gravity. So it's possible, of course, that the dark matter does not interact with Standard Model particles except through gravity. And that's a possibility that's sometimes referred to as the nightmare scenario. And I mean, I think that is a tricky question, right? If the nightmare scenario is true, then one reasonable approach, I think, is to say, look, the nature of dark matter is a really hard problem. It's something that's maybe not even susceptible to the scientific method. And we tried pretty hard, and maybe it's time to go home. Or you can say, well, even independent of any interaction between these hidden sectors and our luminous universe, there can still be rich and complex physics in these dark sectors, just as rich as what we observe. And is there any handle that we can get on that rich physics, even independent of interactions with the Standard Model? And the answer is yes, because as I've said, you're guaranteed to couple through gravity. And so gravitational waves provide this window. And in particular, if the dark matter has a dissipative self-interaction, so that it's able to get rid of thermal energy, then the dark matter can condense and collapse and form compact objects, similar to the formation of astrophysical compact objects. And this provides this direct gravitational window into the physics of the dark matter. So to explore the consequences of this idea in a model that's both reasonably realistic and somewhat tractable, we've adopted what we call atomic dark matter, where you can think of this as dark matter that behaves just like hydrogen. So we have a heavy fermion, fundamental fermion, which you can think of as a dark proton, and it has mass big M. We have a light fermion, which is our dark electron, which has mass little m, and these are coupled by a massless dark photon with a coupling constant alpha. And then the final parameter of this model is the ratio of the dark photon background to the CMB, and we call that C. And throughout, we find it pretty convenient to refer to these parameters not by their absolute values, but by their ratio to the Standard Model value. So for example, R little m is the ratio of the dark electron mass to the electron mass. And already, just from writing down this model, you can see that we can get to some of the physics we're interested in, because the Chandrasekhar mass for the dark matter is going to go inversely with the square of the heaviest fermion in the sector, okay? So that means that if the mass of our dark proton is heavier than the Standard Model proton, and you can already see that you're getting access to subsolar mass black holes. And that's something that's hard forbidden by ordinary stellar astrophysics. So this is not just cute, right? This is something that you can actually see and do with LIGO. So Donghee and Sarah did some initial back of the envelope event rate estimates for the coalescence rate in this model. And the initial estimate is that even for quite a small dark Chandrasekhar limit, LIGO still has some sensitivity. So you should see the chirp mass is our horizontal axis here, and the horizon out to which these events are detectable is the vertical axis. And right now with O4, we're looking at somewhere in between this cyan and the reddish curve. So you can see that for, you know, like 2/10 of a solar mass, chirp mass, there we're really kind of looking only in the local group. But by the time you get up to half a solar mass, and of course having unequal mass ratios will help you out too, you can have some sensitivity below the solar mass range.
Have searches been done at these masses? Do you know?
Yes. And so far, there's no confident detection.
But there are limits.
Right. So before I get into the nitty-gritty of the work that I've done, I do have to make two comments, and I apologize that this is slightly out of context, but otherwise some of you in the room would be wondering about these two issues for the rest of the talk, so it's better to get it out of the way. So the first comment is that these dark black holes that we're forming are not primordial black holes. So you might say, oh, primordial black holes, that's so constrained. There's only a couple of mass windows that are open. And that's true, but that's because with primordial black holes, generally what you're looking to do is have all or a large fraction of the dark matter be composed of black holes. So, you know, if you have a constraint that 1% of the dark matter can be in primordial black holes, well, there might be primordial black holes, but they're not the dark matter. But in our model, you only expect a pretty small fraction of the dark gas to be able to condense and end up in compact objects. So if one part in 1,000 of the dark matter is in dark black holes, that's great. We can still measure that. And so this figure on the left shows some of these limits from primordial black holes. And then you can see if you look at the LIGO O3 catalog, you can get very different constraints in this paradigm, okay? So that's this sweeping red line comes from if you make the assumption that none of the mergers that LIGO has observed come from dark matter. And then these two contours come from two of the most unusual, challenging to explain LIGO events. And they give some inference on what the minimum mass of the dark matter black holes would be if you assume that those were, in fact, dark black holes.
So if we detect one event, and I assume these are binary black holes, right? Yeah. So the only way for me to know primordial black hole is black hole is the
Yeah, so distinguishing primordial black holes and dark black holes, I think in the long run, you will have to be looking at statistics and location. But distinguishing astrophysical from primordial or dark, there you have these very clean mass windows that you can work with. So the other aside that I want to make here is people will say, oh, you can't do this model. Francis Yan wrote this paper in 2014, and only like 5% of the dark matter can be atomic dark matter. And this is a nice paper that's out there, and I'll talk about where this constraint comes from a bit more later on. But the key point is that this comes from an assumption about the temperature of the dark photon. And as long as you make the dark photon cold, which is fine, you can do that, you can have more of the dark matter or even all of the dark matter be atomic dark matter. Okay, so our idea is that we want to generate an accurate forward model of this gas collapse process in the dark sector so that then we can eventually do some backwards inference from the mass spectrum to the fundamental physics. And luckily, the standard model has provided us with an example of compact object formation where the only coolant available is hydrogen. And that's the formation of POP3 stars. So we have this nice schematic of how that goes. So initially, you have this gravitationally unstable gas cloud, which is maybe a few parsecs in size, and it begins to collapse. And you form some hydrostatic protostars, which grow by accretion until eventually feedback shuts off that accretion. And at that point, you have a newly born star cluster, which is interacting purely gravitationally. So if we can get to phase two, we're done, right? Because at this point, we don't care about the dissipative physics. It's just gravity. But there's some added complications, right? Because the dark cosmology has not already been done for us. So we have to start quite a bit further back. And we have to talk about dark recombination and the formation of primordial molecules. We have to talk about the growth of structure and the halo mass function. And then we can get to this interesting cooling physics. So this is basically the outline of the talk, taking you through this schematic to the extent that we have answers so far. Any questions so far?
So is there any nuclear physics in this dark sector?
Yeah, so that's a good question. The answer is, for now, no. In some sense, this is still a toy model. And what we're interested in exploring right now is the long-range dissipative interaction. So, and I'll say a bit more later on about why it's maybe reasonable to neglect the nuclear physics, at least for now. But as a practical matter, as you'll see, this is a complicated enough problem without trying to put in some parameterization of every QCD that you could come up with. So that's what we've been working with.
So your heavy dark fermion
is a fundamental fermion. Right. Okay. So before we can get into the interesting physics, though, I unfortunately have to admit that we spent over a year writing a 30-page paper about the molecular physics of atomic dark matter. And the reason is that is atomic dark matter doesn't just form atomic bound states, it forms molecular bound states, which is like dark H2. And this is actually going to dominate the cooling of the gas at low temperatures. So this may seem quite esoteric, and it is, but I think this is the price that we pay for adopting a model that has a somewhat realistic degree of complexity, is that then we have to actually reckon with the rich and complex physics that we've been dealt here. And if you want to get the right answer, then this is what you have to do. Okay, so what does that look like? So the non-equilibrium molecular chemistry is complicated. There are many reactions and the cooling rates that you need to keep track of. And in general, when you're trying to reproduce the standard model literature, all that you have is these kind of rates, where you have some number with no dimensions associated with it, some temperature, and then maybe some cutoff. And these rates, maybe they come from an experiment someone did in the 80s, maybe it's a quantum chemistry calculation from the 70s. You don't know off the bat. So obviously, to reproduce all of that effort for ourselves is out of the question, right? I mean, obviously, there's no way we can do experiments to measure the dark molecular reaction rates. So the answer, of course, is dimensional analysis. So even though we only had these numbers, which carry no dimensions explicitly, if you dig back into these calculations, you can always extract some dimensionality. So there are certain energy and length scales in these problems. For example, the binding energy of hydrogen is going to go like the mass of our light particle times the square of the coupling constant. The dark Thomson cross-section is going to have a different dependence on those two parameters. And in general, for any of these reaction rates, you're going to have some prefactor that comes from the scaling of the cross-section that depends on these parameters, and then some function that's going to be a function of the temperature over the relevant binding energy in the problem. So you can see in this plot, we plotted some of our dark cooling rates for a range of parameters. And what you're looking at here is this kind of feature is the atomic cooling, and it cuts off. And then below that threshold, you have some molecular cooling. That's what's important at low temperatures. So here I'm just showing you that for all of those reactions that we care about, we did this. We figured out how the cross-section should scale, and we've rescaled those rates from the standard model literature. So with that, we're equipped to put this into our chemical networks and figure out some interesting physics. And the first thing that we wanted to calculate is what's the primordial free electron fraction and the primordial molecular fraction. And those are both numbers that are going to end up being important for determining which halos are able to cool and collapse. So what this looks like for the standard model is something like this, where you have redshift on your horizontal axis, and your vertical axis is the relative abundances. So you have some H2 forming like 1 part in 10 to the 6th at these high redshifts. And then, of course, because we have no nuclear physics, we don't need to worry about these heavy elements like deuterium and lithium. Right. So we've done this for the dark matter. So the plot is schematically similar, but now the redshift of dark recombination, of course, depends on the parameters. So our axis is just scaled by this redshift of recombination. So here's where recombination occurs. And then these black lines are the ionization fraction. The purple is the H2 fraction. And then these other lines are the precursors that you need to form those compounds. So on the left-hand side, you can see one choice of parameters. And here the story is qualitatively similar to the standard model. Okay, you have recombination. You have two bursts of H2 formation that come from when the background photons are no longer able to dissociate H2 plus and when they're no longer able to dissociate H minus. But then here on the right-hand side, you can push the recombination to extremely high redshift if you want to. And then the dynamics do start to get a little bit crazy because the recombination is then happening in an extremely high density environment, which promotes efficient formation of dark molecules. So the primordial molecular fraction can be very high. And I'll just point out that we've implemented the old code RecFast in Julia and expanded it to include molecules and dark matter. So if you have any recombination or molecule formation problem, dark matter or standard model, you can use this code. And it's easier to play with than the old C version. All right. So now we can move on to our next phase, which is the modifications to the linear matter power spectrum and to structure formation. So I mentioned a little bit, there are some constraints on this model. And what this comes from is basically this effect, right? So we're familiar with the baryon acoustic oscillations, which is this little wiggle here, right? But if your dark matter is like your baryons, then the entire dark matter potential is doing this oscillation thing. And so that's what this red line is. And this is obviously observationally a problem. But the solution is that you can just push the dark recombination back to high redshift because this dark acoustic oscillations and dark diffusion damping, those are going to ultimately depend on the horizon scale at recombination. So if you just push things back to high redshift, then you're pushing these effects down to small scales where there's no observational constraints. So that's what we do.
Is this time is the time of dark recombination like a parameter or in this model, or instead like a prediction, like, you know, given the other?
Right. Yeah. So there's two things that determine the time when the dark recombination happens, right? One is the binding energy of the dark atom, which of course you can calculate directly from the mass and the coupling constant, and the other is this dark photon temperature. and that's a free parameter, right? So by making the dark sector cold, you make the time when the background temperature drops below the binding energy, you make that early. So that's the idea. So even if you push these effects down to fairly small scales, you can still have some observable consequence. And you see that in the halo mass function, which you can calculate from the Press-Schechter formalism. But now we have this cutoff in the power spectrum at small scales. So this is something that's sort of familiar from warm dark matter, where we have the halo mass is our horizontal axis. The vertical axis is the number of halos per logarithmic mass range. And then you can see the dashed lines are the cold dark matter halo mass function, and the solid lines are the atomic dark matter halo mass function. So you see that we can have some pretty sharp cutoff that's not too strongly dependent on redshift, right? So no matter how long you wait, you're just not going to form very many halos below this cutoff scale. And that cutoff scale depends on the parameters. Good. Questions about that part?
Did you choose the cutoff scale basically to where the current observations are at the moment?
Right.
10 to the 7?
Yeah, right. This is sort of a cutoff scale that's consistent with you can have warm dark matter that's like a few keV, something like that.
And that's London Alpha Forest is still kind of the best.
Yeah, I think that's still where it's at. Okay. So now we can move on to the main area of interest, which is how this gas actually cools and collapses and hopefully forms some compact objects. So first, there's another clarifying point, which is that not all dark matter halos can cool in this model. And that's also important for observational constraints, right? So for example, there are pretty strong constraints on a dark disk in the Milky Way. So if Milky Way-sized halos are able to collapse, then that's a problem. But luckily, this happens quite naturally. And the sort of crude estimate that you can do to see this is you just assume everything is in equilibrium, and you calculate the atomic cooling rate and compare the cooling time scale to the free fall time scale. And you say, if the cooling time scale is shorter than the free fall time scale, then you're able to get rid of pressure support and efficiently collapse. So here you can see we're moving the mass of our light particle and looking at which halos can collapse. And the cooling mechanisms responsible for this shape are this sort of broad lobe. This comes from dark Bremsstrahlung. And then this extended horn feature comes from atomic collisional excitation. Okay. So what we can do to improve on this is we can take this same chemical network that we derived and applied for the primordial case, and now we can insert it into the calculation for one of these halos. Of course, there's a small problem, which is gravity. If you really want to do this calculation correctly, then you're talking about doing 3D hydrodynamic simulations and embedding the chemistry into that. And that's something that we're working on now and that you'd definitely like to do, but it's a pretty complicated issue. And so we'd like to do something first to have some, you know, estimate of what's going on here before we start turning knobs on these SPH codes. So what you can do is you can just make some ansatz for the density evolution. So you can say, what if we just have a uniform density parcel of gas, and you track the evolution of the temperature and the chemical abundances as it's falling freely into the center of this collapsing halo. And this is an approach that works actually shockingly well. So here on the left-hand side, we've taken this ansatz for the density evolution, that the density is uniform, and rho dot is rho over the free fall time. And we see that for this phase plot, which tells us about the dynamics of the gas, we get all the same qualitative features as the state-of-the-art three-dimensional, you know, fully tracking gravity calculation. And even quantitatively, we're really quite close with this. So this is something that does really work pretty well. Right. Questions about this? I think it can be a little unclear what exactly we did here. So does this make sense? Okay, great. So in that same vein of trying to be as clear as I can be about what exactly we did, we have developed a tool that solves these dark chemical networks. It's based on the standard model code, astrochemical code, Chrome. It's called Dark Chrome. And we pick our parameters as follows. We take our coupling constant to be the same as the standard model electromagnetism. And this is motivated by the fact that we want this coupling to be strong enough that we can have interesting dissipative physics. But if you make this coupling way too strong, then you do run into problems with constraints on, for example, the dark matter elastic self-scattering cross-section. We have to make the dark photon quite cold, right? So we're like a bit more than 1,000th of the CMB temperature. And again, that's required to push these modifications to the power spectrum out to small enough scale so there's no observational problem. And then we choose to simulate a halo mass of 10 to the 8th solar mass. And this is because we've, even with this low temperature ratio, you still have some suppression of structure on small scales. So you're still clearly going to have a pretty good number of 10 to the 8th solar mass halos. But the 10 to the 6th solar mass halos that pop three stars form in, those might be pretty scarce. And then finally, we're going to take the mass of our heavy particle to be greater than the proton mass. And again, this helps with these self-scattering constraints. Those constraints usually come in the form of sigma over m. So if you make the particle heavier, then you have less sigma per m. So that helps. And then, as I mentioned, the Chandrasekhar mass for the dark matter goes with the inverse of the square of this heavy particle mass. So this is the part of the parameter space where we're going to be able to make subsolar mass black holes. So we can walk through the results. Is there a question?
Sorry, just really quickly.
Yeah.
So to go back, if you could go back to the previous slide. So to go back to your sort of aside that you had in the beginning. So if zeta, is that zeta?
C.
C. If squiggly Greek letter is very small, then we can have all of sort of dark matter be ABM, correct? So
that's right.
This is the range where we're considering that, and is that because of the sort of acoustic oscillations that we're pushing?
Yeah, that's right. We're picking this small temperature regime because here all of the dark matter can be atomic dark matter. One small clarification is that in this small C part of the parameter space, the dark diffusion scale is actually larger than the dark acoustic scale, so that's what's responsible for wiping out the small scale structure. But the end of the day, the story is the same.
Okay, so we're still considering a regime where everything.
Yeah, and if you want to make the photon hotter and make less of the dark matter atomic, then you're allowed to do that as well.
Is the ultimate constraint on this C is coming then from bounds on ineffective then, like ultimately? Or?
Yeah, ineffective is not a terribly strong constraint. So the reason that Francis Yan wrote this paper where he considered C of order a half is if you assume that the dark matter was initially in thermal equilibrium with the standard model and that there's no additional heavy degrees of freedom, then you get a temperature that's order a half. But that is just an assumption, right? This is asymmetric dark matter. It doesn't have to have been in thermal equilibrium with the standard model. So it would be interesting to talk to some of these people that are working on asymmetric reheating on whether there are, you know, fundamental constraints on how far we can push C. But as far as I know, there are no hard constraints on that. Okay. So this is our result for the minimum temperature in these halos. So this is a complicated figure, so we should take our time to go through it. So I mentioned, first of all, we have two panels here. I mentioned that we need to make some onsets for the density evolution. So we tried to make two extreme assumptions, okay? So on the left-hand side, the assumption is that pressure support is very strong, and so the collapse is severely inhibited by pressure, and we actually keep the densities frozen at the virial value and track the evolution of the temperature and chemical abundances. Well, on the right-hand side, we assume that there's no pressure support whatsoever, and the gas is able to just completely gravitationally run away. And so that's the rho dot is rho over T free fall that I showed you earlier. So these two panels should give some kind of bracket on the expectation for the dark matter minimum temperature. Okay, so our axes here are the mass of the light particle, again, relative to the mass of the proton on the horizontal axis, and then the vertical axis is the mass of the heavy particle. And the color scale is the temperature relative to the minimum temperature achievable by atomic cooling alone, okay? So the red part, you have no cooling. Dark blue, you have very efficient molecular cooling. And then this kind of gray blue, you have only atomic cooling, but the molecular cooling was never able to take off. And then the final part of this figure is these contours, which are the ratio of our atomic dark matter halo mass function to the cold dark matter halo mass function. So you can see that as we go to a lighter heavy particle, you start to inch that cutoff scale over to larger and larger scales, okay? So we want to be looking at, you know, sort of from here over to here. This is the part of the parameter space that's still allowed. Does this make sense?
Sorry, how is the halo mass function, is the whole thing scaling, or is the, or are you looking at a particular mass, that ratio?
Okay, right. So this is a 10 to the 8th solar mass halo, which enters the calculation through the virial temperature of that halo. So this is how many 10 to the 8th solar mass halos do you have relative to CDM? And that depends on the mass of the light particle because that determines the binding energy, which determines the suppression scale in the power spectrum.
Sorry, I might have missed it, but what's the pressure source?
The assumption is just that this is like dark ideal gas pressure. Okay. So what we're ultimately interested in, of course, is not the temperature. That's still a bit abstract. What we want to get to is the mass scale of these objects. And as I've mentioned, there's already some sort of heuristic ways you can see that we're going in the right direction, right? Which is the Chandrasekhar mass is suppressed when you make the heavy particle heavy. And additionally, the gene's mass depends on the sound speed. So that's the scale where gravity is able to beat out pressure, right? And if you make the heavy particle heavier, then you suppress the sound speed and you're going to make your gene's mass smaller. So we need some way to make that claim quantitative. And the way we do that is from this opacity limit argument, which is due to Riess in 1976. So the way this argument goes is, in theory, as you have fragmentation down to, you know, smaller and smaller scales, this runs away as the density continues to increase, right? But there has to be some point where this fragmentation stops. And the time when that happens is when you're no longer able to radiate away your gravitational binding energy within a free fall time. And that calculation gives you actually an answer that's closely related to the dark Chandrasekhar mass, okay? But now you have some additional fairly weak temperature dependence and additional fairly weak dependence on the mass of the dark proton.
Just to make sure that I'm with you, I mean, so is the assumption here, that this dark gas, is the assumption that the dark gas in the halo is like a uniform temperature, or instead are you allowing for like a multi-phase, gas?
Right. Yeah, so that's back to this, right, where you're right that if you, in real life, you have some small-scale initial power spectrum, and there's full three-dimensional effects from gravity, right? But as you say, our assumption for now is just that you're treating this gas parcel that's uniform and is sort of representative of some little chunk of the gas as it falls into the center of this collapsing halo.
Sure, but to go from halos to, I guess, these compact objects, you have to know something about the distribution of densities and temperatures of the gas within the halo, right?
Well, I think that's actually quite a complicated question, right? So the way we should think about this number really is as a lower bound, okay? This is telling us something about there is no way for you to cool below this minimum temperature in our halo. That's our claim. And if you have that minimum temperature, then that gives you some minimum mass scale. And that's the first hydrostatic scale. And then from there, you can grow by accretion, and then you're going to maybe care about the situation in the surrounding gas more. Yeah, maybe we can come back to it. So for now, if we take this, it's quite straightforward to calculate the opacity limited fragment mass that I just described to you. And all we have to do is plug in this dependence on the mass of the heavy particle and the temperature into that relation. So these figures are identical, except that now our color bar is the mass of these opacity limited fragments as a function of these parameters and in solar mass, right? So you can see that we're able to make fragments up in the tip here that are, one part in 10 to the 8th, or sorry, 10 to the minus 8th solar mass initially. So again, some care is needed in the interpretation of this number because this is the initial hydrostatic protostar mass, if you want to call it that. So for POP3 stars, this number is maybe 1/1000th of a solar mass, and there's a growth factor of something 10 to the 5th. But that growth factor may depend on the detailed physics.
What does that mean? Say it again. So initially you make some fragment of 10 to the minus 3, but this growth factor, it means what?
Yeah, that's you have this this hydrostatic core that forms, and that's the first, stopping point for fragmentation. But after that, you still have gravitationally unstable gas outside of this core. So it accretes onto the core, and the core grows until feedback is able to halt the accretion, and that's what sets the final mass.
Feedback here means radiation.
Right, radiation from this contracting object.
But that radiation isn't coming from nuclear reactors.
That's right, yeah. I'll say a few more words about that in just a moment. Any other comments on this? Okay. Good. So just in time, we can move on to this topic of accretion and feedback. So I will say that the farther you go along this roadmap that I laid out, the more complicated and nonlinear the physics get. And this problem of accretion and feedback and shutting off the growth of protostars, this is still an area of active research, even for the baryons, for pop 3 stars. So this is a hard problem. But there are a few comments I can make which are helpful, okay? So one is that for pop 3 stars, if you know the mass of the initial gravitationally unstable cloud, some order one fraction of that mass is going to end up in the pop 3 stars. Maybe it's 10%, maybe it's 30%. But just by knowing the mass of the cloud, you're already halfway there. And then the other comment is that at this point, you might reasonably start to worry about nuclear physics. Is nuclear physics important for this process of shutting off the accretion? And for pop 3 stars, the answer is actually mostly no, because you have these Kelvin-Helmholtz contracting protostars. And in general, their luminosity comes from this Kelvin-Helmholtz contraction. So you really don't care too much about the nuclear burning, which in general only turns on after you've evaporated off this gas cloud. So of course, there's no guarantee that that remains true. If you introduce some dark nuclear physics, you can make it really weird dark nuclear physics that turns on at some low density. But it at least suggests that there's going to be some part of the real parameter space where what we're doing is reasonable, where knowing the cloud mass and knowing this initial protostellar mass is actually going to tell you something useful about the final mass scale of these objects. And then the last thing that I'll talk just a little bit about, and this is a little bit of a digression again, but as I mentioned, this is an area of active research, even for pop 3 stars. And in fact, the state of the art is pretty much this left-hand figure, where these guys wrote this paper called 100 First Stars, and they took 100 megaparsec cosmological volume, and they zoomed in on all of the gravitationally unstable regions, and for each one of those, they did the full radiation hydrodynamic simulations coupled to the stellar evolution. It's, you know, a massive computational undertaking. And this is their result, okay? These are their 100 first stars as a function of the redshift at which they're forming and the mass of the halo they're forming in. And they fit to these dashed lines, which is an okay fit. And what I've been working on lately is a draft that we're calling zero metallicity and zero CPU hours. So this is now just for ordinary pop 3 stars. And this is a model that can run in a few seconds on your laptop and can get you back the correct mass scale and dependence on the parameters. So I do want to be clear here. Unfortunately, I was not able to find the color scale that they used for this this plot. So I'm not trying to bamboozle you by putting 300 solar mass as the upper limit on my plot and 3,000 on theirs. But this is actually the closest color agreement that I could find in the range of about, you know, 20 to 30 to 100 solar mass. And again, what you see is that I'm getting back about the right mass scale of, you know, you have some part of the parameter space where you're forming relatively massive stars and another part where you're forming less massive stars. And this is like hundreds and this is like 50 solar mass. And then finally, to get some estimate of when those stars are able to form, you can again just draw in the Preschecter mass function. So in this grayed out region, these halos are just too rare for there to be any significant star formation from that region. So this is nice. And there are a few nice things that you could do with this work, including, you know, this is like a cheap thing that you could then insert into some simulations where you're trying to figure out the pop 3 initial mass function, maybe the impact on reionization, things like that. And of course, also, if you so chose, you could try to rescale this model in a similar way that we did with the dark molecular physics and apply this to our atomic dark matter and get some treatment of really the small scale feedback and its impact on the growth of these dark objects. So this is about where I wrap up. The main takeaways I want to have from this talk are gravitational waves can give us very clean constraints on dark matter microphysics. These constraints that exist in the literature, you know, you may go to talks where people will say atomic dark matter can only be 5% of the dark matter. And that's true only because of an assumption about the dark photon temperature. And you don't have to make that assumption. We spent a whole lot of time way out in the weeds on this dark molecular chemistry stuff. And we're starting to have some results to show for that, right? But if this is a problem and if this is a model that interests you, then we've done some of this legwork for you and you can use our tools. You can use Dark Chrome and our Dark Recombination Solver. And finally, we've shown that a large part of the atomic dark matter parameter space is at least qualitatively prone to forming much smaller gas fragments than is possible in the standard model. And that's my ultimate takeaway, okay? You know, we've been doing electromagnetic observations for centuries, and we've been looking for dark matter through direct and indirect searches for decades now. We've been observing gravitational waves for less than a decade. O4 is starting in just a few months, right? If you detect a subsolar mass merger, then you have detected dark matter. And that's something we should be really excited about. Thanks.
So can you say just a little bit more about the previous slide, the zero metallicity and zero CPRs? What was the magic trick that you used to do this so quickly?
I'm not sure what level of detail we're looking for, but there are a few comments I can make. So one is it's related to this kind of one zone trick, which works pretty well, where basically you've already, with this one zone thing, you've reduced the three-dimensional problem to solving a bunch of coupled ordinary differential equations. And it turns out that you can reduce this complexity even further, that there's some time scale argument that holds, so that you can just turn this into an algebraic equation and reproduce the this curve with really quite good accuracy. And then the other comment is you'll notice that there's this like transition between high mass and low mass. And that's due to the effects of deuterium. And so the other part that we're able to get more or less right is some estimate of at what mass scale deuterium becomes important. Right, and one other comment I'll make while I'm here about this figure is you'll notice that there's quite a lot of scatter in the simulation results, which we don't have. And that's because the other important parameter for this model is the rotation parameter of the cloud. How much angular momentum does it have? So to generate this figure on the right-hand side, we've just assumed a typical value for the angular momentum. But if you vary that parameter, then you'll get a similar variety of results. And of course, the dependence is in the correct direction. So that's good. Yes?
Have you, is it possible to think about the pushing it the other way around, like for the mass gap heavier black holes?
Right, you're interested in, like for example, the parent stability mass gap, is that the question? Yeah. Certainly, there are other mass windows that you could explore. And in fact, there is a recent paper by Fernandez, I believe, which talks about trying to do this same thing in the parent stability mass gap. The reason that we prefer to talk about the subsolar mass window is because no one can really fight you there, right? The parent stability mass gap, I mean, it probably exists, right? But the exact boundaries are a little bit dependent on, you know, redshift and metallicity. And of course, you can always say, oh, there's hierarchical mergers. So I think the subsolar mass window is cleaner. Now, if in another, say, 5 years, there's still nothing from LIGO in the subsolar mass window, well, then again, absent any direct or indirect successes, I think this gravitational window is still something that we should be seriously pursuing. But then you start to have to get serious about that kind of question, right? Then you have to look at, well, there's, you know, multiple peaks in the LIGO mass spectrum, and can we try to look at where those are coming from and get some picture of what physics is responsible for that mass spectrum, even without such a clear mass window. Yes?
Is this a question to be purely addressed by LIGO, or is there some looking forward to LISA?
Mm-hmm. Certainly LISA can help. In particular, LISA is sensitive to nearby white dwarf binaries, and that's something that, you know, we might also be seeing, right? Some dark white dwarfs.
Would there be additional modeling sort of needed for that?
Yes. So in our group, Michael Ryan has written a paper about dark white dwarfs. His conclusion is that, so the deformability ends up depending on the model parameters, but that there is a significant part of the parameter space that can be constrained by LISA. I think the question that remains, though, does come back to the details of this collapse process and whether you're, you know, there's some part of the parameter space where the collapse is able to stall out and you're left with these puffy things, or whether you're always sort of growing above the Chandrasekhar limit and then efficiently collapsing down.
Is this sort of like, would you need extra modeling of sort of dark nuclear physics? Because you all sort of had a difficult job, far as I can tell. You said, oh, we're interested in this type of dark matter, so we have to develop a new cosmology and a new chemistry and all of that. Background. So at what point do you need to sharpen those, or are those still valid in the LISA regime?
Right. So again, as we go forward this, I think with this, you have to be really careful about allocating your effort efficiently, right? And so what we've done here is we've said, okay, there's a self-consistent thing you can do. You can tell this whole story from beginning to end, and it more or less holds together, right? And I think that is an important thing to do. But I think in the long run, you know, if you want to consider the whole zoo of dissipative dark matter models, then you may need to be a little bit more phenomenological about it, right? So you're going to start looking at parameters like the tidal deformability, and equation of state. You know, you're not going to like try to do QCD calculations that we can't even do for the standard model to figure out how your dark matter neutron stars work. Does that help? Is that
yeah, no, it was more of just a like, can you push this a little bit further without having to get more in the weeds? Like, at what point will you be forced to get into the weeds?
Yeah, and I think that answer is when LIGO fails to detect subsolar mass mergers for another few years. I still say this is, you know, in that case, this is still a legitimate window to dark matter physics, but it gets even harder. Yes?
Going back to the larger scale, do you think that this kind of model can affect metaclustering at larger scales?
The question is about the clustering at large scales, is that right?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so I think
it has been a discrepancy in the measurement.
So I think that the only impact we should be having on the matter power spectrum is this modification to the linear power spectrum that happens at high redshift and at small scales. And it has to be, you know, from that perspective, you can think about this model as basically doing the same thing that warm dark matter does. Yes.
Yeah, I was just wondering in your simplified model, like how the black hole formation actually works, because you don't have the nuclear physics, right? So I guess you won't have supernovas or stuff like that. So does it just, you know, you just
right
directly until you collapse at some point, or how does it work?
Yeah. So the question is about how do you actually get from these gas fragments that I've been talking about throughout this talk to black holes, which are what we want to observe, right? And that's a good question. And we've done some calculations in that direction that are not yet published. But the short answer, right, is that you don't need to know a lot about nuclear physics to know about the growth of protostars, okay? Right. So like the luminosity, like for example, there's the Eddington standard model of stars that's like from back in the 30s, and he didn't know anything about nuclear physics, okay? But just by knowing, making some assumption about the opacity, he's able to get about the right mass luminosity relationship for stars. So ultimately, this depends more on the opacity than the nuclear physics. And you're right that this is a calculation that deserves to be done in detail. But it's also, in some sense, it seems clear, you know, that you have no additional energy injection from nuclear fusion in this atomic dark matter toy model, right? So it seems somehow obvious that your end state should be a black hole, because there's nothing that's supporting you against this collapse, and you're continuing to radiate as you undergo this Kelvin-Helmholtz contraction.
Other questions? Okay, let's thank James again.